future is in peril. What we need now is a shining hope. Bringing the nation back. One voter at a time. This is Aaron McCready.
Welcome to the show, everyone. Glad you could be with us. We've got a very big show ahead of us, so welcome on board. Let's get some things out of the way real quick. If you'd like to call into the show, the number's 646-200-3400. That's 646-200-3400. We're also being heard around the world on blogtalkradio.com. Again, it's great to have you with us here. Also, I want you to tune in Sunday to the show at 4 o'clock. We're going to have a guest on Sunday by the name of Jack Cariavelli. And Jack Cariavelli worked in the CIA from 1982 to just recently when he retired. And he was in the White House National Security Council from 1996 to 2000. And he was a senior career officer, and he was responsible for the U.S. non-proliferation, can't even say that word, policy, in the Middle East and Russia. And he became Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy from 2000 to 2005. And he also wrote a book, Beyond the Sand and Oil, The Nuclear Middle East, and that is coming up on Sunday at 4 o'clock. But my next guest I am very excited about is Danny Kofke, and he is the author of the book, A Simple Book of Financial Wisdom, Teach Yourself and Your Kids How to Live Wealthy with Little Money. And also, A Simple Book has been endorsed by a handful of people, including Juan Williams of Fox News, Georgia Senator Johnny Isaacson, and Pat Robertson of the 700 Club. And back in 2007, you may have heard of this, and I'm sure you have, he released a book, How to Survive and Perhaps Thrive on a Teacher's Salary. And since, he has appeared on numerous shows, and I am so impressed with this, I'm going to name almost the list that I have, but Fox and Friends, CNN Newsroom, Fox News Channel's Happening Now, the 700 Club, CNN's Your Bottom Line, Fox Business Network's Follow the Money, ABC News Now, he's been on reported in USA Today, Yahoo.com, Money Magazine, Bankrate.com, Parade. The list goes on and on and on. Danny Kofke, welcome to the show.
Hey, Aaron. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thanks for being on. It looks like, evidently, I need to get a new publicist. I need to learn what you're doing.
Oh, I'm telling you, I knew nothing about marketing and how to anything about the publishing industry at all when I wrote my first book. But just through a lot of trial and error, determination, and I think I was fortunate in the fact that the economy took a little nosedive, and some people, they were learning, or they were basically forced to learn how to live on less. And I think that is where my message kind of came across. Here I am, just an everyday person, a school teacher, and a lot of people can relate to a school teacher. So not an economics major, don't have a financial degree, but have basically figured out how to do well financially on a moderate income. And I think that is where my message kind of played to others, to give them hope in these otherwise pretty tough economic times for many.
Right. Well, what really, and you touched a little bit on it, but really, why did you write this book? Because you said, you didn't have any publishing experience, any financial, a financial degree. So really, what made you go in and really write an entire book on, financial matters?
Right. Well, my first book, How to Survive and Perhaps Thrive on a Teacher's Salary, that came out towards the end of 2007. And kind of the inspiration was that for that were other school teachers. My wife, Tracy, was a school teacher as well before becoming a stay-at-home mom when we had children. And at this time, this is before we had children, people, when Tracy was a school teacher, colleagues of ours said, gosh, you guys really know what you're doing financially. You should write a book to help us out. And at this time, this was in the early 2000s, so a lot of people were living like there was no tomorrow. But Tracy and I, we had a goal in mind for her to be able to stay at home when we eventually had children, and didn't know how many we would have or when that would happen. Ultimately, the man upstairs is in charge of that. We kind of have an idea, and we can kind of practice to make it happen. But we were living a life that we were preparing to be able to have her stay at home, and obviously on a teacher's salary at that time, about $37,000 a year, in order to make that happen, we couldn't have a large mortgage. We couldn't have huge car payments, credit card debt. And this was back, like I said, in the time when a lot of people did. They were living like it was there was no tomorrow, racking up debt, buying things, going out to eat, doing all these sorts of silly things, whereas we were, I guess, frugal before being frugal was kind of cool and in vogue. So people just said, gosh, you guys really know what you're doing, and you should write a book to help us out. And I didn't really give it too much thought. And then it was a couple years later, and at that time we had one daughter, Ava, and Tracy and Ava happened to be out of town that weekend, and I'm not very good with idle time. And I think God just put an image in my head, and I just sat down and I started writing this book. And then over the next few months, I completed it. And honestly, it's kind of our story, how we got to the point where we were able to have Tracy be able to stay at home. And I really at first thought it was really neat to have my words on paper for family and friends, and one day to show the kids. Showed it to a few family members, and someone suggested that I should submit it to a publishing company. I submitted it to a couple. I did some research, and to get with the big major houses, you have to have a literary agent. And I really didn't want to go that avenue, but I was fortunate to find a publisher that did accept it. I did have to pay an upfront fee, but I was very excited to have that happen. But then once I realized that my first book was going to come out, that's when I started doing a little research. And there was an actual study done, and this was in the mid-2000s, but done by the National Education Association, and it showed that the average school teacher, they quit within 5 years. And that really blew me away. I thought, golly, is that so that, you know, if I'm sitting in a room full of teachers, half of them will get out of the profession within 5 years. Mm-hmm. Probably not the same right now because of the economy, but when times were good, that was the actual number. And at the same time, there was a general social survey done, and it showed that teaching ranked among the top 10 most satisfying careers. And that's where I kind of wanted to show my colleagues, say, you know what? You can stay in a career that you are passionate about, and it may not pay that large of a salary, but you can still do well financially. And then it just so happened that shortly after the book came out, that's when the economy did take a nosedive. And that's when I thought, not just extend it to teachers, but let's hit those other careers, your firefighters, polices, nurses, things like careers like that, where people get into them because they have a passion first and foremost. And then, the salary, it's hard to complain right now because I know a lot of people are struggling, but I think most would agree that a person doesn't become a police officer because they're making a lot of money. Mm-hmm. You have to have that passion first and foremost. So that's kind of where I wanted to gear that in my message, is just to give people some hope and show them that, yes, here's some tips that enable my family to do it, and hopefully you can do the same. And then we'll fast forward then to 2010. That's when I started my second book. So we go ahead 5 years, and we're still living off a teacher's salary. So Tracy was able to stay at home for 7 years. We added another child to the mix, so two daughters. And despite living off my teacher's salary, and I'll tell you, here in Georgia, this is my 12th year teaching, and I make a little bit above $42,000 a year. So definitely not a large salary. But here we were, and I just felt like I had so much more knowledge to share with others. And I was reading the newspaper and watching TV shows. It's just a constant thing in the news, the economy and how tough times are. And I know they are for a lot of people. But personally, I think that bad news, I know it sells, and I know why it leads off the news, but I think it also makes people just wave the red flag and give up. And they'll say, gosh, if that person can't do it, then I can't do it either. And then they just continue this cycle of negativity, and they don't live the life that they're capable of living. And that's why I wanted this second book to come out. It's just to give some practical advice. I didn't gear it towards any profession. You know, my first book, there was obviously a target audience of teachers in mind, but this book, I wanted to be able to give specific advice to anyone, whether you're a radio show host, whether you're a police officer, a CEO, and all areas in between, and just to show people some good financial tips that they can take right now to do well financially. And that was definitely, just kind of what the premise behind it was, is just to give people hope in these otherwise pretty bleak times.
Right. You know, and I think that you've really hit the nail on the head when you wrote these books, because, you know, people, especially right now when they're struggling, are looking for someone that, you know, doesn't have the financial degree, you know, doesn't have a master's, a doctorate, you know, someone, you know, in the financial area, someone that is more like them, that they can really look up to and relate to. And, you know, I think that's what's happened. You know, people have really, come to respect you, and because, you know, you're a man of the people, so to speak.
Right. I walk the walk, and I think that that's what I try to appeal to others. If, you know, when you're looking to invest for your retirement in mutual funds and stocks, then you're going to want to seek a professional. You're not just going to want to ask the average school teacher for investment advice. I kind of have an idea, but I also use a financial advisor because they're more knowledgeable. When it comes to different types of insurance, then you're going to want to talk to someone. But most people aren't having trouble with that. Most people aren't thinking 30 years down the road. They're thinking, how am I going to make it to next Friday? And that's where I think I can come across and just give people some specific advice and show them how they can manage their money wisely and how they can make it last longer. And it may not be easy, and there's going to have to be some change and some sacrifices along the way, but the good news is that it can be done. It's not just this impossible thing for most of us. I mean, obviously, if you're making, you know, 10 grand a year or something, it's going to be a little more challenging,
right.
But even for the average person that's making, you know, between $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year, it can be done, and that's kind of where I just want to kind of help people with that, because gosh, it really frustrates me. I guess maybe that's part of me as being a teacher, too, is that when I see people, they give up on themselves, and they're not all that they can be. And, you know, finances, it oozes over into so many other areas of our life. Money is not the end-all, be-all, but, man, it helps you live out your dreams. If you have enough money, then some of the things that you're passionate about, you can start doing. And if just think, in our lifetime, if we all did what we were passionate about, gosh, just how awesome of a place this world would be when we're all living out
right.
our dreams and hopes. So hopefully, you know, if we can gain control over the money, that's the first step towards achieving that.
You know, I want to, you know, before we go into some of your practices and, you know, exactly what you do to help some of the listeners out there, you know, I'm just going to play devil's advocate for a second. And, you know, some of them may say, oh, you know, Danny's got a book deal. He doesn't have to worry about money, you know. But, you know, and that may or may not be true, but you were practicing all these practices years before you wrote the book.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of what enabled me to write the book. And I'll tell you, I've heard that too. People say, gosh, you're this big author. And even as much publicity as I have had, I'll tell you, and especially for you aspiring authors out there, it really, you know, I guess unless you sell a book, you know, about a love stories with vampires or, you know, an erotic novel like The 50 Shades of Grey, that's the new big one, you're not going to make a large salary. My first book, I mentioned before, I had to pay an upfront fee of almost $4,000 to
wow.
have it published. A known author, and that's fine. But with my second book, even after appearing on all the national shows, I did get a publishing deal, but I didn't get an advance or anything up front. It just, the book was published at no cost to me, and I do get royalties from it, but it's not that large of a royalty. Maybe out of every book that sells, I get less than 10% of the price. So you don't, unless, like I said, you're this big-time, you know, Stephen King novelist, most authors don't make it on their books alone. So, you know, just throw it out there just so people, when they say that, gosh, oh, yeah, you're a published author, you make a lot of money,
right.
Well, it really, it adds a little bit to it, but it's nothing that I can quit my day job and just be a full-time
right.
author, that's for sure.
Gotcha. Well, what exactly are you doing? How are you surviving, and how are you thriving on the teacher salary?
Right. Well, the first thing that helped us so much is that we had a plan, and I talked about that a little bit earlier, where we knew where we wanted to be. And, you know, in anything in life, if I'm going to take a road trip, say, from here to Georgia to California, I would consult a map to know how to get there. The same thing holds true with our financial lives. If we want to reach a certain destination, we have to have a goal in mind. And a lot of people do not do that. They don't think about retirement. They don't think about next week, next month, and their budget. So that, to me, is the first thing that we did that helped so much for us to achieve that, is we had a destination in mind. We had both short-term goals, you know, 1 month, 1 year, 5 years, and then longer terms, 20 years, 25, 30 years down the road of where we want to be. And the cool thing about that is just helps you say no to some of the temptations that are so easy to give into. Because let's face it, Madison Avenue spends billions of dollars a year to get our hard-earned money.
Right.
And we see advertisements. I read a recent magazine, and it said the average American is exposed to over 24 million ads by the time they hit 21. So companies are fighting to get our money. But when you have that goal in mind, then you know, gosh, okay, this is going to either help me or hurt me reach that goal. For instance, when Tracy and I, while she was working before having children, it would have been very easy for us to go out and buy nicer cars or to buy a bigger house or to go out to eat more. But we knew down the road we wanted her to be able to stay at home, and to do that on a teacher's salary, we knew we had to have an emergency fund in place and pay off as much debt as possible. So it made, because we had that goal in mind, it made it a lot easier to succumb to those instant gratification types of things because we had our eyes on a bigger prize. So that, to me, is number one. It's just have a goal, have some places where you want to be in mind. And that's with anything. I mean, goals are very important in all aspects of life. So that was a big key. And then number two for us is we know exactly where our money is going. And it still amazes me when I talk to people and try to give them some financial advice. They'll say, Danny, I have absolutely no money. Yet they have the newest iPhone, they'll have a new Coach bag, they'll have new clothes, whatever. And I'll say, well, actually, you do have money.
Right.
You're just choosing to spend it in this way. And so many people, they just don't realize that. So what I recommend, and this really worked well for us, is for 1 month, walk around with a piece of paper and a pencil and write down everything you spend. Now, this isn't going to be easy. It's going to be inconvenient. You're not going to have to rip out that paper every time, but it opens your eyes, and then you're able to see. Because I could give you some general tips, a latte factor, don't buy coffee out, or don't buy snacks from a vending machine, whatever, but it may not be personal to you. You may not have that problem, but a lot of us, we have areas in our lives that we overspend in, and we don't realize it. So taking the time to write them down for at least 1 month, then at the end of the month, you're able to analyze your personal spending habits. The numbers aren't going to lie to you. You're the one that wrote them down. Then
right.
You can see, oh, my gosh, you know, we went to the movies three times this month, or we ate dinner out, or whatever it may be. And just an easy example of how fast little things add up. Let's just say during the work week, say Monday through Friday, eat lunch out every day. And we're going to keep it cheap. We'll say fast food, not a lot of money. Say $5 a pop.
Okay.
Now, most of us, we're not going to miss $5. We're probably not even going to think about spending $5. But when you add that up, $5 a day during the work week adds up to $25 a week, which is $100 a month, which adds up to $1,300 a year. And for most of us, $1,300 can go a long way, and that's just on $5 a day. So that, to me, is just such a key, is to know how your money is being spent, because there's two ways to make more money. Either A, have to get a higher-paying job, which, let's face it, it's possible, but it's a little more difficult right now for most of us than it was 5 or 6 years ago. Or B, we have to cut back on what we're spending money on, which puts more money back into the bank account.
Right. You know, while you were talking, I was thinking, you were talking about, you know, people don't have a lot of money set aside. And I think Bankrate, not too long ago, came out with a study that only 24-25% of Americans have enough for at least 6 months' expenses in case, you know, something happened. You know, in my opinion, I think it's, you know, Americans have lived the good life, and we haven't came across a depression or a big recession, and we haven't had to put money back, and we haven't had to look at the big picture, that everything's been, you know, just short term. Do you think it's because of that we haven't really had to struggle, that only 25% only have money put back for 6 months?
Yeah, you know, and I would be surprised if that number's not even lower. 25%, I don't know. I didn't read that study, but that seems even high to me, because a lot of people don't even have money set aside for next month. And I do, but my generation, I'm 36 years old, we've never really been through times like this before. Kind of the entitled culture, where a lot of us, we've gotten everything we wanted because times were good for so long. The advice that I give, it was advice that was given 50 years ago, 100 years ago. It's nothing new, but a lot of people didn't pay attention, and that's where I think, when I was talking earlier about why my book, it gained so much attention, is because people were forced to make that change because they did lose a job. They were forced to live on less, but I think for so long that people, we think our houses are going to go up 10% each year. We're going to get guaranteed raises in our jobs every year. That's not the way life happens. Yes, there's some years it does that. And you go along for a few years and everything's fine, but we have to be prepared. And you can go back to grandparents, great-grandparents. They always say, you got to save for that rainy day. And unfortunately, a lot of people have been caught without an umbrella because they just did not put that money aside. And you can even go back. I like to go back as far as people that went through the Great Depression. A lot of them that are living right now, They may not drive a Rolls Royce. They may not live in a 4,000 square foot home. But many of those people, they have an adequate emergency fund put aside because they know what it's like to have to stand in food lines. They know what it's like to go through tough times. So my hope in writing these books is just to focus on the positive. You can't do anything about the situation you're in right now. If you can't pay your electric bill, you're behind on your mortgage, whatever. I cannot imagine that. I'm sure that situation and feeling is horrible. But my hope is that you learn from this lesson and you move forward and make sure, because times will get good again, but you remember this time and make sure that you never allow yourself to be in this situation again.
Well, do you recommend that people get another job or a side job, or do they, should they just change careers just altogether?
I think whatever you're comfortable with and whatever works best. For some people, I mean, changing careers can be more difficult, I think, for a lot of people because change is always hard. But I have no problem with that. If you know you have something lined up and it's paying well, and that's I think that's a great option. But also getting a second job, I think either one of those works. Now, thing is, with getting a second job, you don't want it to last forever, and you want to have a light at the end of the tunnel, because who wants to work two or three jobs for 20 years? That's no fun. We do want to enjoy life, but until you can get a hold of your finances, I think sometimes that's a step that needs to be taken in order to get on top. Fortunately, especially when you're talking debt, when a lot of people that are in such deep credit card debt, and with the interest payments that you're paying, it can be very, very hard to dig out from that hole. So I think any way necessary, you may have a few rough years, but you have to have that light of something you're working toward, so hopefully you don't have to work two jobs the rest of your life.
Wow. Well, on a teacher's salary, can you still buy what you want, or do you have to really cut back?
It's interesting on the jazz that, because I feel like we buy what we want, but we just don't have it all. When we were on the CBS Early Show back in the fall, they actually had one of the producers came down here and filmed us in our home, and he came down from New York, and he's looking around our house, and he's like, I don't understand. He goes, you guys have everything that all of my friends have up north, and you seem like you have it all, but yet you're doing it on this moderate, on this low salary. And he's like, well, I don't understand. Why are people in debt, and you have on this salary, what don't you have? And I said, well, when you look around, I said, we don't have granite countertops. We don't have the biggest house. Both of our cars, my car is almost 10 years old. Tracy's car is, 7 years old now. So we don't have it all. We don't have everything new. And I think that is the mentality that so many people have for so long, is I see it, I want it, I'm going to buy it, and not think about the future ramifications of those decisions. So when we look around, I do feel like I lived a very a wonderful, blessed life. I have it all, but it's just not everything new. If I want to go out to dinner every night of the week, well, then something's going to have to give. I can't do that, or I'm going to have to get out of teaching. I'm going to have to get a second job, get a higher-paying job, whatever. So I think that is kind of, when I look at our life, is I do feel like we have plenty, but if I compare it to other people of why they got in the financial mess, is we don't have everything that we want. We're not able to go and, go to Disney World every single year. We're not able to go and spoil our kids and buy expensive clothes every single month. Now, we can do it occasionally, and we can save up and do those types of things, but I guess we just don't have it all. I mean, I do think we have it all, but I guess in some people's minds, we wouldn't be able to do it whenever we wanted to. So I think that is kind of the biggest difference. But I guess kind of the cool thing about it is, like I said, I do feel we do have enough. And when I kind of compare myself to other people, we do have as much as they do. It may not be newer, it may not be as big, but we still have it.
Right. And, I think, too, you're casting the shadow of a leader, onto your children, because your children are seeing the example that you're setting. And then they are more likely to follow in your footsteps and be more responsible with money and do the things that you're saying.
Absolutely. And I'm very open and honest. And I have two girls, 7 and 4. So I know 10 years from now it might be a different conversation, two teenage girls. But hopefully we're laying a good, solid foundation right now. But I'm open and honest with them, because especially my 7-year-old, she's of the age now where she does notice those things where people have more than she does and friends may have a bigger house or whatever. And there'd be times that she'd come home and say, Dad, how come so-and-so has this nicer house or nicer cars or whatever? And I'll say, well, Ava, that you could have the same thing, but Mommy and I have made the choice that she was able to stay at home and raise you and your sister Ella, and I like being a teacher, and teachers unfortunately don't make a large salary. We do okay, but it's not CEO pay. Said, but you know, we could have nicer things, but this is what something would have to give. I'd say, you like me being a teacher, because she actually attends school, the same school I teach at, so I get to drive her in the morning. Sometimes I pop in and see her while she's eating lunch. So it's kind of a cool relationship that we're able to do that. I'd say, and you enjoy that, but that's going to stop, because you see some of these dads that pull in the driveway at 6:30, 7 o'clock at night. I say, that will be me, because I'll have to work longer. I said, oh, and you like Mommy being at home when you get home from school now. You liked it that she was home all through your childhood before you went to school. Well, that's going to change, too. You're going to have to go to the after-school program, because she's going to have to work and get a full-time job, and you're never going to see really much of her either. Now, we'll have a nicer house. We'll have nicer things. We'll have nicer cars. But you're not going to be able to spend as much time at home enjoying those things. And then she'll say to me, it's so amazing with a seven-year-old, but she'll say, you know what, Dad? I think we got it pretty good. And then she'll just go off and play. So it's just, I just want to kind of teach both of my girls that, you know, action A leads to B. You can have certain things, but something is going to give. If I go out and I buy a Mercedes, I could do that. But something's going to have to give. I'm going to have to either get out of teaching and get a higher paying job, get a second job and see less and less of my kids, or have Tracy go back to work full time so we could support that lifestyle. So I think that is kind of hopefully the lessons that I want to teach them, is just have open, honest discussions about money, but just show them there is a price for everything. And even if you put it on credit, you may think, well, I'm not paying it, but you are, and actually you're paying it a lot more in the long run. So I just think right now, and I'll tell all you parents out there, it is so important to talk about money matters with your children, because as a school teacher, we do not teach financial literacy in schools. I think it's horrible. I think it's a crying shame, but I can't change the system. I know why. It's because it's not on the state test that many of us give. So I understand the reasoning behind it. But saying that, you as a parent, you're going to be the one your child has to learn from. And a lot of us, we don't want our kids to suffer like so many of us have. So even as a parent out there, if you have made a mistake with money, who cares? Be open and honest. To me, if you've made a mistake, even better, because there's no one perfect on earth. And you can just tell your kids, you know what? I really messed up. You're going to mess up in life. But the important thing is I learned from my mistake, and I'm never going to allow it to happen again, and I'm going to grow and get stronger. And I expect the same thing out of you, that when you do make those any type of mistake, you're going to learn from it and grow and not let it happen again. So that's where I think a lot of parents, money has become this taboo topic. I've even read a study where parents are more comfortable talking about the birds and the bees with their kids than they are about money. So I think we have to just really be open and honest about it. And like I said, if we screwed up with it, that's okay. It's okay to make mistakes. I think your kids will even appreciate you more and think, wow, you're human. You messed up too. And they'll learn even a better lesson. So to me, like with most things, honesty is definitely the best policy.
And I'm going to play devil's advocate again, but you know, there may be people out there say, oh, Danny, that's fine and great that you're able to do all this and you know, not spend as much money as someone, but I bet that you're not putting anything away for savings. Is that right or wrong?
Oh, well, that's wrong. We actually have a one-year emergency fund set aside. So that was kind of established while Tracy was working. We kind of add to it as much as we can. But living off a teacher's salary, we don't have a lot left at the end of the month. So we prepared ourselves for that. But for our retirement, we still invest right now. Gosh, I guess it's over 10% of our salary is invested in our retirement accounts. And we've done that since the moment that we were teachers. So it's just kind of been an automatic thing. And over time now, I mean, even with the stock market going down, back up right now, our retirement account, even at a relatively young age, in our retirement account, we have more than our what we earn in a year so far. So, and it's going to continue to grow. So, no, that would be false. We continue to invest every single month, use the magic of compound interest, dollar cost averaging, and then hopefully 30 years from now, if all goes well, we'll be able to retire as millionaires. So, no, I mean, the important thing is when you are looking to set money aside, most of us, maybe not so much anymore, but there were studies done a few years ago where the savings rate, it was at a negative percent. We were spending more money than we even had coming in. Mm-hmm. So knowing that, being the humans that we are, a lot of us do spend up to what we earn. So we almost have to trick ourselves and pay yourself first. And this is what works well for us, and this is what we started, like I said, when we first became teachers, first got hired, is every single month a set amount of money is automatically deducted from our checking account. After I get paid on the 31st of each month, the money is taken out and invested automatically into our mutual funds for our retirement accounts. We don't have a chance to see the money. We don't have a chance to get used to it. We don't have a chance to spend it, because if we did, a lot of times human nature is we spend all that we have.
Right.
So now, even if we did spend everything that we had coming in, because we pay ourselves first and have that money automatically taken out, at least we still know every single month we are investing for our retirement or for our future. So that is just such an important thing to do, especially for people that are just starting off. Just set up an automatic deduction and put it into that an IRA or whatever type of investment vehicle you want to use, and just do it before you have a chance to get used to that income coming in. And over time, like I said, compound interest, it just works wonders in how much it can grow, and that's the way the average person becomes really wealthy. You hear stories and talk to people all the time that were just maybe a post office worker or a firefighter or a teacher, whatever, and by the time they retire, they have a nest egg of $500,000 to $1 million, and that's what compound interest will do for you. And I know a lot of people are wary of the stock market and they get afraid, but when you look at the historical average of the stock market going back 100 years, it averages about 10% growth each year. Now, some years it's going to be up 20%, mm-hmm. some years it's going to be down 20%.
Right.
But when you look at this, and that's why you have to have time on your side. A lot of people, they messed up. They went into it blindly. They trusted their financial advisor, I guess, too much and didn't know enough, weren't knowledgeable enough. And when the stock market crashed, a lot of people did lose a lot of money. But as you get older, near retirement, that's when you do want to diversify a little bit more. And you don't want to be so heavily invested in stocks. And you want to kind of have more of it in cash so you can, if it does drop, you still have plenty of money. But while you're younger, I know people a few years ago when the stock market got down to whatever it was, like 6,500, people were saying, oh, you know, the sky's falling and we're losing everything. But I look at it as a young investor, I don't want my money for another 30 years. So basically, with dollar cost averaging, you're just buying the same shares of mutual funds every single month. I looked at it like I was getting them on sale. The stocks I was investing in, I was buying them at half off. I'm not going to sell right now. I want to sell 30 years down the road. So hopefully if I buy it right now when it's at, you know, $10 a share, hopefully down the road, 20, 30 years down the road, it's going to be $20 a share. I'm doubling my money. So I think that's just where you have to have a long, a big picture view of it. And just like I said, know that the historical data shows that it averages about 10% a year. We're not trying to time it and get in at this time and get out at that time. If you just let your money ride, invest a set amount each month, mm-hmm. Many, many people have become wealthy by following that method.
And really quick, then we're going to go to a quick news break. But I saw on TV somewhere, and you were being interviewed, but you had said a story, and I cannot remember where I saw it, but you had told a story about you and your wife that when you first started to save that you got a set amount of cash out of the ATM each week. Mm-hmm. Can you tell that story a little bit?
Yeah, this is this went back to when we were kind of budgeting for our weekly expenses. After we wrote down everything we spent for that 1 month, we were able to analyze and see how much we needed on a weekly basis. And this is for your groceries, some entertainment, gas, whatever it might be. This wasn't for mortgage or anything like that. This is kind of our disposable income, I guess. And we figured out a set amount that we needed on a weekly basis, the average amount. And while you're doing this, you may need to play with this number. It's not always going to be the precise the first time you figure it out. But we kind of came up with a good amount of what we needed on a weekly basis. And every Friday, we would go to the ATM machine and pull out that exact amount. Then, anytime we'd go to the store, whatever we'd use, we'd have to use cash. And the great thing about this is because a lot of people right now, we don't think much when we swipe a piece of plastic through a machine. A lot of us don't have an emotional attachment to it. But when you whip out a dollar bill out of your pocket, it's a lot harder to spend. We know how much sweat went into earning that dollar, and it's very, very difficult to part with a lot of times. So using a cash-only system, it kind of helps on those spontaneous buying things that a lot of us do without thinking. It kind of causes us to think twice at least. Do I really need this? Am I really going to part with my money? And another thing, too, is a lot of people I talk with, they'll tell me they're so busy, they don't have time to balance their checkbook. Well, here's one transaction a week. You're making one ATM withdrawal, the money's out. If you don't have 30 seconds in a week to write that down, then we got some other issues besides money issues, I think.
Right.
So it helped, and it just helped keep within our spending, because let's just say if it got to be Wednesday of next week and we wanted to go out to dinner, but we didn't have any money left. Well, we're going to have to eat in tonight. We're going to eat a bowl of cereal, make dinner, whatever. We're not going to be able to eat out again until Friday. Like I said, it's not going to be easy at first, but it prevents you from overspending. You know exactly how much money is going out. You're not spending your money frivolously, and then it's under control. And I'll tell you, this didn't last forever. Like I said, kind of with a second job, you may not want this to last the rest of your life, but because it is so ingrained in us, we did this probably, I guess, 4 or 5 years, that we were easily able now to switch over to a debit card, and we kind of use that in the same manner, especially after having kids. It's kind of a pain to pull them out of the car seat to go in and pay for gas and everything. But because it is ingrained in us, and if you start off using this method, then it kind of becomes second nature, and you don't think of the debit card as just this piece of plastic. You kind of think about it as cash because it's coming out of your bank account in the same manner. But no, that worked really, really well for us, and it helped us stay within the spending budget that we had for each week.
Great, that sounds good. Do you have time to stick with us after the news, or do you need to get going?
No, I'm fine.
Okay, well, we are currently talking with Danny Kofsky. He is the author of A Simple Book of Financial Wisdom, Teach Yourself and Your Kids How to Live Wealthy with Little Money, and then also How to Survive and Perhaps Thrive on a Teacher's Salary. We're going to take a quick news break, and we'll be back right after this.
Fox News Radio. I'm Chris Stanley. Americans had to recalibrate their view of modern life on the high seas when pirates began raiding boats and ships off the Horn of Africa a couple of years ago. Well, now a Somali man has been convicted of piracy in a U.S. court. Fox News Radio's Jared Halpern is live with that story.
A federal jury convicting Mohammed Shabeen for his role as a hostage negotiator during the hijacking of a U.S. yacht last year off the African coast. The four Americans aboard were all killed, the first Americans to die during a string of hijackings in the Indian Ocean and Gulf of Aden. The Somali man also convicted for a kidnapping and hijacking of a German merchant ship in 2010. The mostly Indian crew was tortured. Shabeen faces a mandatory life sentence. An appeal is expected after the August sentencing, Chris.
All right, thanks, Jared. California has been having problems with its nuclear plants, and now a new one has sprung up. Let's go live to Los Angeles and Fox News Radio's Jessica Rosenthal.
Chris, the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant in San Luis Obispo already had one unit down for scheduled maintenance, but this week they had to shut down the other unit because of a jellyfish-type creature.
The salp were entering the intake structure. There were so many of them that we couldn't continue to safely operate the plant.
Diablo Canyon spokesman Tom Cuddy says this should not affect providing energy to their customers. Both Diablo and San Onofre's nuclear plant to the south use ocean water for cooling. San Onofre's shut down because of excessive wearing on tubes and its relatively new generators, Chris.
All right, thanks, Jessica. The House of Representatives has passed a bill that would stop interest rates from going up on student loans this summer, but the mostly party-line 215 to 195 vote found Democrats giving it a thumbs down, even though they want the rate hike blocked as well. That's because the GOP-backed bill replaces the money that would have come from the rate hike with money from the Obama administration's health care law, money the Democrats say is critical to preventive health care, particularly for women and children. You're listening to Fox News Radio, Fair and Balanced.
There's more to Fox News Radio than meets the ear. Go behind the headlines and join the conversation on the hottest stories of the day on the Fox News Radio Facebook page. Be a part of the Fox News Radio Facebook fan community. Post comments and tell us your opinion. See behind-the-scenes photos and videos and post your reactions to the stories that matter to you. Click the like button on Facebook and connect with breaking news and features like Fox in the Fast Lane, House Call for Help, and more. Go to Facebook.com/Fox News Radio.
Never give in. Never give in. Never, never, never. In nothing, great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense.
Winston Churchill's immortal words stirred an entire country in the face of certain defeat. Today, these words give each of us the courage to reach for our own victories.
Never give in. Never give in. Never, never, never.
Commitment. Pass it on. From the Foundation for a Better Life at values.com.
You've all heard about Amsterdam and its drug tourism. Well, now the government there is planning on tightening the reins on who gets high in this low country.
A judge in the Netherlands upholding a government plan to ban foreign tourists from buying marijuana anywhere in the country. They're proposing a weed pass offered only to Dutch citizens and permanent residents. The goal is to crack down on people who drive in from other countries and buy larger quantities of pot to be resold at home. But there's concern it would have a chilling effect on tourism or drive tourists to street dealers. Some of Amsterdam's famous coffee shops say they're prepared to challenge any ban by ignoring it. Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Moose Scourin, a power-hitting first baseman who played alongside Mickey Mantle and Roger Maris with the New York Yankees title teams in the 1950s and 60s, has died of congestive heart failure at a hospital in Arlington Heights, Illinois. He was 81 years old, Hall of Famer. Yogi Berra says there weren't many guys better than Moose. A Major League Baseball player, now in major trouble.
He's the left fielder for baseball's Detroit Tigers.
Down the left field line, that ball is hooking. It's a home run for Delvin Young.
That from Fox Sports Detroit. Now Young has been accused of committing a hate crime. New York City police arrested him after he allegedly yelled anti-Semitic remarks, then got into a fight with some tourists who had been approached by a panhandler wearing a yarmulke. That's how a 32-year-old Chicago man claims he wound up with scratched elbows. 6 years ago, almost to the day, Young threw his bat at an umpire in a minor league baseball game. Young and the Tigers are playing the New York Yankees this weekend. In New York, Ron Flatter, Fox News Radio.
Louis Armstrong fans, rejoice. There's a live recording of Satchmo playing his trumpet near the end of his career that's never been released to the public, and now it is. It's from January 29, 1971, when Armstrong was a featured performer at the National Press Club in Washington. He died less than 6 months later, and now Red Beans and Ricely Yours, Satchmo at the National Press Club, has just been released on CD. I'm Chris Stanley, Fox News Radio.
The future is in peril. What we need now is a shining hope. Bringing the nation back. One voter at a time. This is Aaron McCready.
From time to time, we've been tempted to believe that society has become too complex to be managed by self-rule, that government by an elite group is superior to government for, by, and of the people. But if no one among us is capable of governing himself, then who among us has the capacity to govern someone else? We're not, as some would have us believe, doomed to an inevitable decline. It is time to check and reverse the growth of government, which shows signs of having grown beyond the consent of the governed. Can we solve the problems confronting us? Well, the answer is an unequivocal and emphatic yes. And after all, why shouldn't we believe that? We are Americans.
Welcome back to the show, everyone. If you're just joining us, the first half of the show, we've been talking with Danny Kofke. He's author of A Simple Book of Financial Wisdom, Teach Yourself and Your Kids How to Live Wealthy with Little Money, and then also author of the book How to Survive and Perhaps Thrive on a Teacher's Salary. And he has appeared on many, many news shows and articles in newspapers all across the country. We're going to join Danny back on the show. Just wanted to get your opinion. What do you think of teachers' unions? Are they good, bad? Are they necessary?
As a teacher, sometimes I'm asked to answer this, and I probably don't give the most popular answer coming from teachers, because I know many are in the union and support the union, and I do think the unions are good to a degree, because they were created. You could have some bad principals that could just get rid of a dynamic teacher for no reason whatsoever. And unions also, especially in today's day and age, where there are some parents out there that they do like to file lawsuits, so I know unions can do the legal protection that a lot of teachers don't have enough money set aside to sometimes to pay for those court costs. But I think the unions have taken a black eye recently just because of the support of bad teachers. And a lot of us heard the reports of the rubber rooms in New York City where you had these teachers and they are doing crossword puzzles that were bad teachers, and they sometimes sat in there for 2 years while their cases were heard. So I think that is just the degree where I disagree with teacher unions, is in the support of teachers that don't do a good job. I think teachers should get help that they need and, hopefully improve their teaching practices. But at some point in time, if you're not doing the job in teaching our youth the things they need to learn, then it's time to find another career and not just be supported by a union that will constantly just, kind of put you in a different position and kind of, do the dance around and assign you to different classrooms. So I understand both sides of it, but I just wish sometimes that we would reward our teachers, our better teachers, and I think I'm okay with pay for performance when they do a good job. So that's where I think unions do take a black eye, because then they're in the news, publicized a lot, and then a lot of the general public will say, gosh, look at this union, they're fighting for this bad teacher, and then they just get a bad perception of all teachers, and they just kind of throw all teachers in with this one poor one, and then it hurts our entire profession. So like I said, I kind of see both sides to it, but I do disagree with the practice when unions do protect bad teachers. I think it just puts a black eye on both professions, actually, the unions and the teaching profession.
And you have firsthand knowledge of that also, don't you? When you walk down the hall and saw a teacher, just showing TV shows or movies to her class?
Yeah, that's kind of, where it kind of makes people not want to get into the teaching field. And I totally understood it, because this is a few years ago, and I was teaching kindergarten at the time, and there was a veteran teacher down the hall from me that, I don't know, she probably had 20 years on me, and the way teachers are paid, it's based on your education level, but also based on the number of years you're in the profession. And I was, fourth year teacher at that point in time. And like I said, this teacher had a lot more years than I did. And, I'd go down to go to the bathroom or whatever during a break, and walk by her room, and almost every single day there was a movie on, and just kids sitting there watching a movie. And I remember thinking at that time, I could go back to my classroom and I could teach the most dynamic lessons ever created. My students could grow 20, they could graduate, that year, and they could be reading 5 grade levels above what they should be. And I'm still going to get paid less than this teacher that watches videos all day. And that, to me, is the unfortunate part of the teaching profession. And that's why I said I'm okay with pay for performance, because not that test scores are the end-all be-all. I think if we went to pay for performance, there'd have to be some other elements to it as well. But to me, it was just a crying shame that I thought, how many classrooms is this happening in across America, too, that, these people get comfortable. And this teacher, I had heard, she was there before I was, and this was my first year at that school at the time, but I had heard that it was the classic dance, that the principal did try to get rid of her. She was teaching upper grades at that time. The union backed the teacher. Principal had to move her. She moved her to the library to become the librarian, and then they put her in the computer lab, and then those positions weren't available, so they just put her in the classroom that they thought, I guess, she could cause the least amount of damage in, and
wow,
would have time to grow. So it happened to be a kindergarten class. So when I heard those stories, that's just where I do get frustrated sometimes with the unions, because it's not fair. They're hurting our students, and in fact, they're hurting the teaching profession, because there probably would be someone else that could take that teacher's place and do a better job. And not everyone's cut out to be a teacher. As a teacher, when I teach students, there's some students that are great at math, some are great at reading, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. If you aren't a good teacher, that's okay. If you're trying to still teach, I don't think it's good, but we're not all called to do that. Each of us has unique abilities and talents, but when we kind of let someone stay in a field that they don't really belong in, I don't think it's doing that person any good, too. So I think it's just a lose-lose situation all the way around.
I was looking into this too, and we wonder as America why, and these are some statistics I got from the Broad Foundation, that 70% of eighth graders can't read proficiently, and most will never catch up, and then 1.2 million students drop out of high school each year, 44% of dropouts under the age of 24 are jobless,
right.
$300 billion with a B, in lost wages, lost taxes, and lost productivity due to dropouts from the class of just 2007, and $190 billion in lost income and taxes due to each cohort of dropouts. And then also, we're 25th in math out of 30 countries, Out of 183 countries, we're number 45 in literacy, and Russia, Cuba, Ukraine, Hungary, France, Japan, and Denmark are ahead of us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess, you know, with that said, I guess Iran's number 98, and we can just pray that they can't read instructions to get the bomb, you know. But yeah, what do we need to do to get all those numbers up to be the leader of the world in education and just make this country stronger?
Well, here's where, you know, since I kind of have an inside track, I will tell you, I think sometimes those numbers are misleading. I do think there's definitely room for improvement, but this is what happens here in the States. And I would venture to say in other countries, I don't know firsthand, but I wouldn't think it's happened. When we're balancing test scores here in America, we count every kid. Right now, I teach special needs students, and the class I teach here in Georgia is known as a severe profound class. So my students have IQs under 30.
Mm-hmm.
Diapers, tube-fed, they don't talk, they're in wheelchairs, so really, really low. Saying that, I still, as part of No Child Left Behind, I have to give what is known here as the Georgia Alternative Assessment. Instead of the statewide test that a gen ed student would receive, I do this special test for these students.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it works is, let's just say I have a student that's in fifth grade. I have to, and this kid could have, and I've had it, had IQ, under 30, so very, very low. They don't even they don't go to the bathroom independently. And I have to take two strands that a gen ed fifth grade student would learn from English, two from math, one from science, and one from social studies. So I'll have to teach this student that doesn't even know their name, that doesn't talk, the difference between vertebrates and invertebrates, how to add three-digit numbers. I mean, just ridiculous things. And
right.
I have to do this twice a year. I do it at the beginning of the year, and then I have to do it at the end of the year, and I have to make this student show growth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the student, they don't have, and it's okay, but they just weren't born, a lot of them, with the IQ to do that.
Right.
But I have to show the growth. Now, if I do not show the growth, then that affects the No Child, that's part of No Child Left Behind. It affects our adequate yearly progress and all those types of things, because it's a subgroup of the larger groups that they take, that take the test. So I'm just kind of point that out, that we have to test every single student. So whether it's low, high, whatever. And I guess I would venture to say that maybe some of these other countries that we're comparing ourselves to, I don't know if they have the same testing mandates in place, where even, 20 years ago, the students that I teach, you didn't even see them in school. I never saw them in public. I know they were around, but you didn't see them. So I think here in the States, and I think that is a plus of us, that we do include all kids and we do try to teach them all. But I think in other countries, even when you have some of those students that may go to be car mechanics, and that's fine. I think that's a great career. But
right.
here in the States, we'll still test them, and we have to make sure, okay, in 12th grade, we're still testing them. They may never go to college. They don't need that test because they have a unique skill that they're able to do that they don't need to be book smart in order to do it. Whereas
mm-hmm.
in other countries, I know sometimes the career path, by the time they hit middle school, they'll veer off, and if they don't need to take the same type of test. So sometimes I do think when we look at standardized test scores compared to other countries, it could be comparing apples to oranges. Not trying to defend our country. I do think there's plenty of room for improvement, and I think we
right.
can do a better job. But I do want to just throw that out there, that when we are comparing ourselves to other countries, I don't think it's always I don't think it's an adequate measure of how we're doing, because like I said, we test, even like I said, the students I teach with very low IQs, they're counted in those test scores too.
Well, and when I say this, I don't mean to be snide or sound insensitive,
mm-hmm.
anything like that, but you have the students that have a below 30 IQ. And if they, really don't even know their own name, and you can't really teach them those items, I mean, what happens to that student? I mean, do they just, stay in school forever? Does the system give up on them? What exactly happens?
Well, no, we don't. With special needs students, and it may be national, but here in Georgia, they go to school until they're 22. And, with the students that I teach, they're kind of to the extreme because they are so low. So their parents kind of understand. They'll probably... they'll probably live with them the rest of their lives. They'll need that ability. I do have a couple that when they get into the middle school and the high school, they do gear it. They try to more job type of skills. And there are some other special needs students that, you know, have a little higher IQ and that can communicate. And there's a couple of classes of those at my school as well. But those are the kind of kids that, you know, they can have jobs at the grocery stores and little whatever fits their needs. I'm not just trying to limit the grocery store, but whatever is best for them. But once they get into the middle school ages, usually that's when they do go out in the community a little bit more and they do more specific job training type skills so that they can be contributors to society, because I think all of us want that for everyone, and ourselves, we enjoy that too. So those students do have all the ample opportunities to do that, but while they are doing that, they still have to take the standardized test.
Right. Well, Danny, I really do appreciate you being on the show. You've been very good to come on, and you are welcome back anytime. And again, for all of our listeners out there, he has got a couple books. A Simple Book of Financial Wisdom, Teaching Yourself and Your Kids How to Live Wealthy with Little Money, and then also How to Survive and Perhaps Thrive on a Teacher's Salary. And how can our listeners get those two books if they so desire?
Both of them are available on Amazon.com, but you can also see and learn more about me. If you just, probably the easiest way, if you Google my name, so Danny Kofke, DannyKofke. The first thing that usually pops up is my blog page, DannyKofke.blogspot.com. And on that page, there's a direct link to email me, direct links to order my books, check out my blog, and some of the links to the various media appearances I have made as well.
Oh, well, great. Well, it was a pleasure having you on the show, and you are welcome back anytime.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me on, Aaron. I enjoyed talking with you and hopefully helped your listeners.
Oh, I'm sure you did. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Danny Kofke, and, you know, a fascinating person. He is not a financial guru. He did not go to school for finances. He did not go to school to become an author. But, you know, he saw a need with his fellow teachers at the time. And so he created a book. And, you know, man, oh, man, did that book take off. He's made appearances on Fox News, CNN, Fox Business, MSNBC, The Clark Howard Show, you name it, Consumer's Digest, Women's Day Magazine. So he was very, very good to come on, and I hope you did learn something. Now for the remainder of the show, we're going to get into what I like the second half of the show typically to be, and that is to defeat President Barack Obama. He has, of course, you know, just ruining the country. I'm not going to repeat myself. I've said every single show. Everyone knows what I think of him. But, you know, when we have statistics like we just talked with Danny, 70% of eighth graders can't read proficiently. 1.2 million students drop out of high school each year. 44% of dropouts under the age of 24 are jobless. You know, we're 45 in literacy out of 183 countries. We're 25th in math out of 30, 21st in science. Where is the leadership? Where is the leadership? Have you heard old Mr. President say anything about education? He's more concerned, as most politicians are, about keeping his job. That's the politician's number one job, is to keep their job. It's not to create jobs. It's not to help you. It's not to help me. It's so they can win re-election. And how do they win re-election? It's by making you more reliant on the government. That's how they win re-election. That's how the Democrats get in power. You know, you hear the Democrats talk all the time how evil the Republicans are. You know, it's not the evil Republicans. They say raise taxes on the wealthy. Well, it's not that taxes are too low. It's the spending. We've got a spending problem in the country. You know, when the federal government collected $2.2 trillion in total tax revenue back in 2010, $2.2 trillion in total tax revenue. Income taxes account for $900 billion of collections, or about 40% of the tax receipts. But the federal government, now get this, So we took in $2.2 trillion, okay? The federal government in 2010 spent $3.5 trillion. That's $1.3 trillion in the hole. Trillion with a T, not billion with a B, but trillion with a T. Now, if you did that each and every year in your own finances, what do you think would happen? You'd be homeless. Well, you know, I guess the next owners of this country, whoever they are, I hope they treat us well. Looks like it's going to be the Chinese. The Chinese are walking all over us. Walking all over us. I just don't understand anymore. Just don't understand anymore. And then we've got this. You know, you heard all about the Secret Service. The big scandal with the Secret Service. You know, Director of Homeland Security went on Capitol Hill and said, oh, that was just an isolated problem. That was just, you know, just yesterday. Well, guess what? Listen to this.
In recent days, I have spoken to a lot of people who either worked for the Secret Service over the past several years or who are closely associated with it. And what is emerging are polar opposite views. In one camp, I hear that the Secret Service is a highly ethical agency where any type of shenanigans is frowned upon and that agents take great pains to protect one another from any behavior that could damage the agency or the president. But in another camp, I hear that there is a culture of risky behavior that manifests itself when supervisors are away. Listen to this security consultant who has hired former Secret Service agents and whose firm has worked closely with the Secret Service.
An ongoing thing has been going on for decades where when someone is out of the country, when a team is out of the country, it is out of sight, out of mind, and it's almost a what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas mentality as applied to an overseas environment.
In regards to a series of new allegations, one that agents patronized prostitutes during President Obama's trip to San Salvador in 2011, the Secret Service has told congressional investigators that there is nothing credible to that, but they continue to investigate many leads. In regards to newer allegations of partying at strip clubs in Moscow and in Buenos Aires, the Secret Service says this statement still applies. It was issued yesterday, and it says the recent investigation in Cartagena has generated several news stories that contain allegations by mostly unnamed sources. Any information that is brought to our attention that can be assessed as credible will be followed up on in an appropriate manner. And one source tells me the farther back these rumors go, the more difficult they are to investigate, John.
Now, how about that? You know, it sounds like this has been an ongoing problem for, what, the past 10 years or so? Isn't that what they said, the past 10 years? You know, it makes you wonder, it makes me wonder, whether you're a Democrat, Republican, Independent, Libertarian, it doesn't matter, but makes you wonder, who do they protect? Where is their leadership coming from? It's coming from the president. I mean, who knows? Maybe they're scouting out there for the president. Maybe they're getting women there. Maybe they're getting hookers for the president. And I'm not just talking about Barack Obama. I'm talking about even George W. Bush. I mean, my gosh, they said it started 10 years ago. What, 10 years ago was 2002. If they said it started 10 years ago, it probably started 15, 20 years ago. Well, guess who's president before that? Oh, Mr. Lewinsky was president before that. Probably started with him. He, who knows? I don't have any proof of this. I'm just speculating. Who knows? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. I'm not saying it happened. But it makes you wonder. Makes you wonder if Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama are in on it. I mean, I don't know. Do you? You know, why would the Secret Service think it was okay to do that on a presidential trip? You know, granted, these people were, you know, the lead team getting ready, you know, planning for the president's visit, making sure the security detail for the president would have all the necessary items that they need. If you want to call into the show, please give me a call. It's 646-200-3400. I would love to debate you on this. If you're a Barack Obama supporter, maybe you could call in and tell me why you don't need a handicap tag on your car. If you do agree with me, call in 646-200-3400. You can go to blogtalkradio.com, join our online chat in the chat room. But give us a call. I'd love to hear your thoughts and opinions on our fantastic president. But, you know, I just want to tell you a little bit more. You know, we were talking earlier about finances, and I touched a little bit on this yesterday, but I think it's so important that I want to ingrain this in everyone's head. Since we were talking about finances, and I talked about this yesterday, so if you heard the show yesterday, you know what I'm going to say. But this comes from the Heritage Foundation, and they call it Taxmageddon. And January 1st, 2013, get ready, a $494 billion with a B, tax increase, the highest ever in 1 year, is going to take place on January 1st, 2013. The average American household will see its taxes rise by $3,800 just in 2013 alone. And that's not including 2014, 2015, when that amount will probably go up. You know, Adam, the producer of the show, my call screener, he's saying to me, and you guys can't hear him or see him, but of course you can't see him. We're on the radio, for goodness sake. But he's saying to me, you know, the world ends in 2012 anyway, so what does it matter? We'll just pay the $3,800 and keep on trucking. But I want everyone out there to take a guess. This $3,800, what do you think it's going to pay for? In 2013, what do you think this $3,800 on average that every American household have to pay on average? Of course, some will pay more, some will pay less, but $3,800, what do you think that's going to pay for? Well, guess what? It's going to help pay for Obamacare. For all you morons and idiots out there that think you're going to get free health care, guess what? It's costing you $3,800. I don't even pay that much in health insurance from my employer. You know? But now because Obamacare, because people think that health care is a right. Health care is not a right. Pull me the Constitution. Somebody please show me where it says you having health care is a right. Having health care is a privilege. You need to work for it. You need to get off your lazy hind end and do something about it if you want health care. And I know there's going to be critics out there saying, oh, Aaron, you know, there's people out there that are disabled and can't work. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about you, the one that's sitting there on your lazy rear end and won't get up out of your chair because you'd rather be eating Cheetos and watching TV than go to work. And then you're going to say to me, but the economy, I can't find a job. Okay, when's the last time that you went out looking for a job? You probably can't because you're probably about 500 pounds from eating all those Cheetos, being lazy, watching TV. Watching the Oprah Network. That's what I think. You want to call in, disagree with me? 646-200-3400. We're live. You can call in. You can talk to me. You'll talk to Adam first. If you want to reach me, then act somewhat intelligent or he'll drop your call. You won't even reach me. That's what happens time and time and time again. We don't have intelligent callers, so they don't reach me. That's why you never hear callers on here, because Adam does a very good job at the call screening. You listen to some of the episodes in the archives on Blog Talk Radio, you'll know what I'm talking about. You know why we screen all the calls. I mean, just idiots call in. And thanks to Adam, he prevents them from getting their say on the radio. I mean, it's just crazy. But you know what? Your $3,800 in health care? What do you think about that, Adam? $3,800 in health care?
That's quite expensive. I was just going to ask if you had saw the new ad the Obama campaign had released.
No, what have they released? I'm afraid to even ask.
Not, It was the an ad on Bin Laden saying Romney would not have gone after Bin Laden.
Do you believe that?
As a bear.
I mean, do you believe that?
I don't believe it, but
I mean, I have a thought. Is it a believable ad?
Yeah, it has a Romney quote in it.
What did he say?
I don't remember the quote directly, but it has Clinton narrating the entire, like a minute or so.
You know, Clinton,
advertisement.
You know what? And Clinton's wanted to talk. You know why I say that? Because when he ran against George H.W. Bush, when Clinton became president and George H.W. Bush didn't get a second term, you know what that campaign was about? George H.W. Bush, you know, liberated Kuwait from, you know, Iraq. Iraq invaded Kuwait. Well, George H.W. Bush was going around saying how he liberated Kuwait, how he was a war hero. And you know what? You know what Bill Clinton said? He was strict to his message, and he said, that is fantastic that you, it's just great that you liberated Kuwait, but just wish that you were as good at creating jobs as you were liberating Kuwait. He stuck to that message, and he even came up with the slogan, it's the economy, stupid, and guess who's president? So maybe Romney needs to take a book from the narrator himself and stick to that. What do you think?
The economy, in a way, goes back to Clinton, if you really think about it.
How does it go back
to
Clinton? We had economic gains in the Bush era, too.
Well, if you... I wasn't saying that. I started with Clinton. I was just saying if you looked at the, what is it, the North Atlantic Free Trade Agreement that was signed, and with, had some things with the housing as well, if I'm not correct.
Right.
About this, with the subprime loans.
Well, you know
that
what?
That kind of started everything.
Well, you know what? That's really something for Clinton to narrate that ad. You know why? Because Clinton had Osama bin Laden in his sights, and Clinton made the conscious decision not to take him out. Did you know
that's
that?
True.
Yeah, I mean, that's just ridiculous. Well, I mean, the Clinton.
The ad even talks Obama having the courage to go after bin Laden.
You know, any president.
Clinton narrating the ad.
Well, you know, the only thing that Barack Obama deserves credit for. I mean, I don't even know if he really deserves credit for that, because what president in their right mind, knowing what happened after 9/11, who was really the mastermind behind it, who was leading the terrorists? You know, what president in their right mind, when the military would come up and say, Mr. President, we have Osama bin Laden, would you like us to take him out? What president sitting in that chair would say no?
Right, exactly.
You know, I mean, the people that deserve credit are the men and women of our military that went out there and tracked him down and hunted him down. You know, Obama is just the figurehead, because any president would have said, take him out. The Clintons just make me want to vomit. They really do. And I'm surprised Clinton is even doing an ad for Obama, because Hillary and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and President Barack Obama, they really don't get along. I just don't understand. Maybe Hillary needs a job so bad that Bill Clinton has to suck up to Obama so she can keep her job. You know?
Right.
That's going to be an interesting question. You know, maybe we should ask that, what Jack Caravelli thinks on Sunday about that, because, you know, he worked with the National Security Council, and he was on the National Security Council staff from 1996 to 2000, and he was responsible for the U.S. proliferation, is that how you say it? Policy in the Middle East.
Proliferation.
I can't say that word, proliferation. His responsible for the U.S. non-proliferation policy in the Middle East and Russia, and then he became Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy from 2000 to 2005, and he directed the Department's International Threat Reduction Programs. That'd be an interesting question to ask him. We're going to talk about Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran. You know, on Sunday. But I'd love to ask him that. Anyways, what else you got, Adam?
I was going to try to play the ad back if you give me a one moment.
Oh, okay. You know, have we had a lot of loons call in?
No.
Not a lot?
Not too many. Not tonight.
Well, yeah, well, loons don't like to talk about money, I guess, because they don't have any.
Well, it's Friday night. All the loons are out partying.
Oh, yeah. So that reminds me, all the listeners out there, if you're in your car, if you're walking around, because you can pick up the show on your iPhone, on your, you know, BlackBerry, on your computer, radio, you know, whatever, watch out for all those loons that are out drinking. You know, there's idiots out there, and, you know, unfortunately people do drink and drive, so, you know, be defensive and stay out of their way. You got that up yet?
One moment, sir.
Well, hit me back when you do.
Okay, sure will.
That's Adam, our call screener and producer of the show, and he's the one that gets all our fantastic guests on the show, like who you heard tonight, Danny Kofsky. We also had Malcolm Out Loud the other night, and we had David Clark yesterday, former presidential candidate for president of the United States in 2012. But, you know, like we've been talking about, we cannot afford four more years of Barack Obama. What's going to happen 4 years from now? Look what happened. Look, where are we at from the previous 3.5 years? Did he give us change we can believe in? I mean, we have a president that when he doesn't have a teleprompter, this is what he sounds like. That's the president we have. You know, at least George W. Bush mixed up his words, but at least he, without a teleprompter, he could say something besides You know, what experience does Barack Obama have to be president? Somebody call in and tell me, please. Somebody sane, call in and tell me. 646-200-3400. We're going to go back to Adam here, and he has the ad up that was just released today of Barack Obama, his ad, saying how much of a hero he is, and Bill Clinton narrating it. You got that ready, Adam?
I got it ready. I hope you can hear it. We will see.
Okay, let's listen to it.
That's one thing George Bush said that was right. The president is the decider in chief. Nobody can make that decision for you. Look, he knew what would happen. Suppose a Navy SEAL had gone in there and it hadn't been Bin Laden. Suppose they'd been captured or killed. The downside would have been horrible for him. But he reasoned. A good conscience do nothing. He took the harder and the more honorable path, and the one that produced, in my opinion, the best result.
It's not worth moving heaven and earth, spending billions of dollars just trying to catch one person. He was referring to the hunt for Osama bin Laden. What did he mean by that? Because it's generated a little controversy, given Osama bin Laden's role in killing, what, 3,000 Americans on 9/11. He had to decide. And that's what you hire a president to do. You hire the president to make the calls when no one else can do it.
Bill Clinton, what an idiot. Yeah, we hired the president to make the calls when no one else could do it. We hired the president to create jobs. How many jobs has he created? I don't know of any. Not a net gain. Oh, gosh, what a mess. Of course, Clinton, the one, he's big to talk. He's the one that had, Bin Laden in his sights and decided not to take him out. Gosh, that just irritates me. Yeah, I'm going to need blood pressure medicine, Adam, after you play in that. I might fall over and just have a stroke right here in my chair.
I believe they just released that ad today.
You know what? Everybody listen to talk radio tomorrow. Listen to Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity tomorrow. See what they're saying. They're just going to have a field day with that idiot president, the idiot's president. I had a little bit of respect for Bill Clinton until then. Not much. You know, man, I don't know. Well, thanks, Adam.
You're welcome.
646-200-3400 is the call-in number for the show, as you just heard that fantastic ad. That just makes my blood boil. You know, I'm going to ask our next guest on Sunday about that. You know, what he thinks, if he thinks the president that would be sitting in the chair at the time, if they knew that, Osama bin Laden, and not just Barack Obama, but if the president at the time had Osama bin Laden in their sights, if on Sunday when Jack Cariavelli comes on the show, if he thinks the president would have said yes, no matter who it was. I just don't understand. You know, if I guess that's all he has to go on, then I guess, you know, that's a feather in his cap. I guess that's what he gets to do. I mean, that's the only thing, accomplishment he has. He had no record before he was president. He has no record now, that's for sure. You know, and something else that just came out, and this was on CNBC, those liberals. CNBC. Student loans, they're trying to get student loans the next bailout. You know, they actually had a decent article. It almost sounds like that they were being... you know, fair and balanced like Fox News. What do you think, Adam?
Well, I was just going to say, did you see where it was on? Obama was on Jimmy Fallon narrating and singing about this.
But what they call it, not the slow news, but the...
slow jam.
Slow jam. The news to slow jam. That was ridiculous. That's, talk about somebody trying to, you know, dig deep for something, you know. And you know what? You know what the kicker is? They had that vote today to stop raising the not to raise the student loan.
No, the Democrats voted against it, didn't they?
Yes, they did. The Democrats voted against it, and the Republicans voted to lower the keep the loans low for the Stafford loans. And Obama is just an idiot again. His own party voted against it. Oh, gosh, what a mess. You can catch that on YouTube. Jimmy Fallon, that's who it is, Adam?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, look up that Jimmy Fallon and Barack Obama. You'll see it on YouTube.
He's more of a celebrity than he is a leader, or a president, or a leader.
Oh, he is. And, you know, what's even worse, he's taking Air Force One, you know, all around the country, and according to the statutes, the president, if he or she, he to date, is running for re-election and they use Air Force One for campaign reasons, the campaign has to pay the Department of Treasury back for the cost of Air Force One. Well, you know what Barack Obama does? I guess presidents have done it before, but Barack Obama has been doing this. Is what he'll do, he'll make campaign stops, but he'll also throw in business on the trip too, so he can write it off as a presidential visit and not a campaign trip. Doesn't that just make you irate?
Yes, exactly. Been to, I believe, your hometown twice, once on the campaign trail and once as president.
Oh, I know. He did do that. You should have saw traffic down here in Atlanta. And for those of you who don't know, I broadcast the show out of Atlanta, Georgia, and Adam produces and screens the call from Bristol, Virginia. But so, you know, we're not even in the same room. But you should have saw the traffic down here, Adam. It was ridiculous. 285, 85 was backed up. because of the presidential motorcade. And, I mean, they do make helicopters, right? I mean, doesn't the president have Marine
right.
One? Isn't that a helicopter? And,
I believe so.
Why couldn't he take that to the Playboys, I mean, the Secret Service, you know, to go to an elementary school, cordon that off so Marine One could land there closer by instead of tying up all that traffic? I mean, you talk about loss of productivity for workers. Of course, I guess the president doesn't care about that because he doesn't know how to create a job, so why would he care? It's all about him. All about him. Am I right?
Right.
646.
We have what?
Do what? Go ahead.
I was just going to say we have about 6 minutes left in the show. What are three points that do you think Romney can beat Obama on?
Well, I certainly don't think it's health care. Definitely not health care. Because, you know, Obama the other day celebrated the anniversary of Romney Care. You know, I think it's going to have to be Romney stick to a message. Romney created jobs. Yes, he also fired a lot of people, but you know, you have to cut the fat somewhere. So it's going to be jobs. It's going to be Romney's organizational efforts with business. You know, making business succeed, because government needs to run more like a business. If government ran more like a business, we wouldn't have had 1.3 trillion deficit in 2010. We took in 2.2 trillion in tax revenue, but the government spent 3.5 trillion. So we had a deficit of 1.3 trillion. Romney is a businessman. He ran Bain Capital. He got the Olympics back on track. He never let that happen, $1.3 trillion deficit. So, you know, those two things. And I think the third one is just sticking to a message, not bouncing around. Don't fall into the trap of what they're trying to get Romney into with focusing on Osama bin Laden. I think Romney just needs to ignore that and stick to the message, just like Bill Clinton did with George W. Bush. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Well, we're going to wrap up the show here. We got only 4 minutes left, and we had all the loons call in, and they didn't get on the air, thank goodness. But, again, next Sunday we're having a show, same channel, blogtalkradio.com, or you can actually go and hear the archived episodes at blogtalkradio.com or aaronmccready.com. That's AaronMccReady. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can email me personally, Aaron, Aaron, at aaronmccready.com, or Adam, you know, our producer, Adam, at aaronmccready.com. And then also, if you want to be a guest on AM in the PM with Aaron McCready, then feel free to email bookings, BOOKINGS, at aaronmccready.com. And again, you can listen to none of our episodes are really pre-recorded. They're all broadcast live, but you can hear archived episodes ever since we started doing the show on aaronmccready.com. So, you know, I would like to thank everyone for being a part of the show. I really want to thank, you know, Danny Kofke, the author, and he's been on Fox News, been all around promoting his book, for taking the time out of his day to come on AM and the PM. And again, 4 o'clock on Sunday, we have guest Jack Cariavelli. In 1982, he began his career in the CIA, and then he moved to the White House National Security Council from 1996 to 2000, where as a senior career officer, he was responsible for the U.S. non-proliferation policy in the Middle East and Russia, and he became a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy from 2000 to 2005, directing the Department's International Threat Reduction Programs, and he also authored a book, Beyond Sand and Oil, The Nuclear Middle East. So make sure you check that book out. All those books previously mentioned on this show can be bought at Amazon.com. But, you know, we're going to talk about the Middle East. We're going to talk about Afghanistan. We're going to talk about Pakistan. We're going to talk about Iran. So, you know, it's going to be a very, very serious show come Sunday. But I want you to remember, you know, whether you agree with me, whether you disagree with me, you know, it's very important that this election cycle that you go and you do your own research. Don't take what I say like it's the Bible. Don't take any other radio host. Don't judge a book by its cover. Don't listen to the TV. Don't listen to or newspaper. Do your own research. That's why we're in the trouble we're in. That's why we have the president we have. Because he looked good. He talked the talk. It won't happen. So make sure you can do your own research. Now, control what you have control of. We need a change in this country, and change that Barack Obama promised isn't change that we need, that this country deserves. We are a great, great country. And yes, I know times are hard right now, and I know there's a lot of people out there that lost their job, but it's not simple. We're going to get through this. We will get through this. Make sure you go to the ballot. You think Mark Obama's the right choice for you, vote Obama. But just do the research. It was great to be on the air with you. Catch us Sunday at 4 o'clock.